We had the privilege to bring Steve, Professor Steve Keen, back on the show. Steve, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Love having you on the show, mate. There's a lot to talk about with what's happening in the macro land. I've been trying to digest all this information and was thinking about some of the stuff. I'm like, who can answer some of the questions for us? Then obviously the good old name came into mind, Steve Keen. But Steve, let's start with the, in the last couple of months with the COVID and all, we have seen there's a lot of stuff happening with the QE money printing that's happening. I wanted to first touch on what were your thoughts on all this QE that is being done currently, how and whether the Fed will be able to unwind the balance sheet. And secondly, a question on what's the big difference between the QE and MMT?
Well, I mean, first of all, in terms of whether they can unwind the balance sheet, to some extent, the answer to that is no, because a major thing that central banks have been doing ever since they got involved in QE is trying to support asset markets. And that's the one thing QE was successful at. If you look at the American QE, which began, well, you can date it to the actual crisis when Bernanke increased the level of excess reserves dramatically, like about from virtually zero to about $4 trillion in a matter of a couple of months. But you date it from the actual beginning, formal beginning of QE, the stock market bottomed at 666. That was the value of the S&P. I thought it was quite an amusing number, very hard to forget. It reached virtually 3,000. Now, that was largely because with the Fed, what the Fed does with QE is it's always involved in what they call, you know, what are called open market operations, OMO, buying and selling bonds off the financial sector, trying to maintain the target interest rate that the Fed has already set. And with the QE, they said, we're going to be on the buy side of that net, $80 billion per year, which is roughly $1 trillion per year. Now, that meant that on an annual basis, rather than, say, coming out towards zero or not too far from zero, which was often its previous target, it was coming out with $1 trillion worth of bonds. Now, that meant it put $1 trillion worth of cash into the financial sector. But the financial sector's assets went, bonds went down by $1 trillion, cash goes up by $1 trillion. As financial institutions, they are required to use that money to buy financial assets. They can sit on it as cash if they're, you know, particularly scared about the future, but they'll have to buy risky assets. That was the actual intention, it's published intention of QE, to drive up asset prices because they believe it would cause a wealth effect, and the wealth effect would stimulate the economy. Now, for a start, their wealth effect analysis found there was no particular wealth effect out of the shares. This is not another story. But if you think about the cost of the financial sector, you know, the salaries, the ludicrous salaries that people get paid there, the cost of the transaction fees and so on that out of which that income comes, you might imagine maybe one-tenth of that money dribbled into the real economy. Mm-hmm. Okay. But most of it drove up asset prices. Now, when they try to unwind, the reverse applies. Okay, they're trying to sell bonds to the financial sector, which means the bonds of the financial sector rise, their cash holdings fall. How do they get the money to buy the bonds? They sell shares. The share market collapses. What does the Federal Reserve do? They go and rescue the shares again. So they're stuck. They're stuck in a, I called it a pact with the devil when it was first put forward. You know, once you've signed on the dotted line with Mephistopheles, you can't unsign. So that's the dilemma there. Now, what they're doing this time round is closer to what I believe they should have done in the first place, not QE for the financial market, but QE for the people. Give people cash directly. If you look at QE as it was actually done, as I said, you might imagine that maybe 10% of the money they pumped in actually got into the real economy, and it got there through the salaries and the profits of the financial sector. Not exactly the world's... because they earn so much, they consume so little. Okay, it's a very, very poor way to get money from Wall Street to Main Street. Now what they're doing is putting it straight into Main Street. So they're giving people, you know, like they think it's $1,200 in the case of the American economy, a substantial amount more in terms of it's a continuous payment in the UK and Australia and New Zealand and places like that. And that is necessary because at the moment people don't have any cash flow at all. So without the government cash flow, most people, most workers, would run out of money in less than a month. So unless the government's providing money at the same time as they're saying you must be on lockdown, then it just really can't work. So it's a sensible policy, but as usual, they're not doing enough of it. They're too worried about the level of debt they're running up, which is nonsense because they are effectively just with the debt they're recording the amount of their own currency they've created. And what I like about QE, rather this particular experience of it, is that all the stuff that I was told could never be done is now being done. And one of those things is one of the rules of the virtually every major economy is that the central bank cannot buy bonds directly off the Treasury. Well, that's been thrown out the window in the UK, and now the Treasury is selling bonds directly to the central bank. Now, if you think about what's going on, the central bank prints pieces of paper, which they call bonds, which they've got a value of £100 billion. Okay, and then they record that as a notional asset because they haven't sold it yet. Then the central bank buys it off them. So the central bank takes 100 trillion of those bonds and values that at 100 billion and puts that inside on its asset side. And on its liability side, it puts £100 billion in the Treasury bank account and says to the Treasury, go spend. And then if there's any interest being charged on those bonds, well, that interest has to be paid by someone. Who's it paid by? The Treasury. Who owns the central bank? The Treasury. So where did the profits and the pay of interest go? Back to the Treasury again. In other words, there is simply an accounting operation going on to create £100 billion worth of money, which is then spent by the Treasury into the real economy. And that is fundamentally what QE, what MMT tells us, that all these things are just accounting operation. There is no limit on the capacity of a government that prints its own money to print its own money. Okay. The question then is, what is the impact of it doing that on its economy? That's the constraint. The constraints are the effects of money creation, not the possibility of money creation. So that's how I could tie QE and MMT together.
QE, you are still supposed to unwind the balance sheet, but whether they can do it or not, that's a separate question.
Well, no, but one thing again that I like about QE is I can ask people, how much tax did you pay to support QE? And I normally get a puzzled look out of people, huh? And that's right, you paid zero tax, okay? There was absolutely no taxation needed to finance the central bank buying $1 trillion worth of bonds per year off the financial sector, okay? Mm-hmm. In other words, okay, it doesn't need tax in order to spend, and that's one of the points of MMT. You don't need taxes to spend because the money itself is created by the government and by the banks, which is another story, private banks. But the governments can create that money without limit, without practical limit, okay? And that effective limit's a different story, but a practical limit doesn't apply. So therefore, taxes aren't needed to spend. Taxes are used to take money out of circulation when there's too much money being created by the government. If the government, which is of the order of 30 to 50% of the GDP of every economy on the planet, if the government simply finances spending by printing money and then not taxing it back, then the money supply would be growing at 30% per annum. Mm-hmm. Now, even non-orthodox economists will say, yes, that will cause rampant inflation because the economy doesn't grow at 30% per annum. It grows at about, when it is growing, at about 3%. So you have to take that money out of circulation. That's the role of taxation. So that's the useful point coming from MMT about the capacity for governments to finance themselves. QE is just a case of central banks, which never understood money properly until after the financial crisis, now some of them are starting to understand money properly, being managed by mainstream economists at the board level, who know less than their research staff do, and who still believe that government that the inflation is caused by government money printing, when you have the normal level of government money creation, that simply is not the case. So they believe they've got to unwind any debt creation they make, and they don't have to. But with QE, they've completely stuffed up their own way of controlling the interest rate. That was where we had the flash crash about 1.5 years ago now, when overnight rates went to 10%, because they used to manage reserves using what's called a corridor system, and then they flooded the corridor effectively. And then over time, they slowly leaked that corridor out. So you got back to the stage where the corridor applied and they weren't applying corridor rules anymore. So you had a breakdown in the interest rate overnight. But they don't have any limit on the money creation capability. We've seen it with QE. MMT simply said that's a general principle.
Right. So, Steve, does that mean that we are really at the end of this debt cycle now? This whole debt cycle that has been going on for however many decades since 1970s or early, has it come? Is it about the time that it needs to come to the end, or are we gonna? How far can we kick the can down the road now? Is the question.
What debt cycle are you talking about, private or public?
Both.
Which one do you think matters, private or public?
I think they both matter. Private is equally as important.
Well, the private debt is the main one that matters because private institutions don't own their own banks. Okay, so there is a practical limit on how much private institutions can take on. No, there's no way this is the end of the debt cycle. In fact, it's probably the beginning of calamity caused by the debt cycle. That's one reason I've been arguing for the proposal I put forward a decade ago, knowing that would have no chance of being implemented, a modern debt jubilee. I'm now talking about it because I think it's about the only policy that is going to save the financial system in the long-term future. I'm just going to bring up a chart on the screen. That's why I'm being a bit quiet in my talking here. Just give me a second to put a chart up together. We have a huge level of private debt, the highest in the history of capitalism at the moment. And this is not recognized by mainstream economists because they don't think the level of private debt matters. So they record the data, but they never look at it. Okay. Now, what I want to show you is why we're nowhere near at the end of the debt cycle. And if you look at what's happening with the level of debt that's been taken on by corporations, particularly in America, we're likely to have a debt crisis. It's probably in the middle of the coronavirus crisis. Things like seeing the crash of Hertz yesterday was just the beginning of the bankruptcy we're likely to see. So just give me a second to share my screen here,
sure.
Because this is a long-term view of the America's debt level, private debt level. So the red line is the level of private debt over since 1835, mm-hmm. Okay? And this has been ignored by economic theory indefinitely. The blue line is the rate of change of private debt, and you can see this is the Great Recession, where there's negative credit. The rate of change of debt is negative, equal to -5.2% of GDP from +15. That's what caused the Great Recession. A similar thing called the Great Depression. From there, it was from 8.7% down to -9. And there's another event called the crash of 1837. I've actually just not quite included that on the data there, unfortunately, but you can see as well that there's negative credit running at -8.8% of GDP. That's what causes financial crises. Now, we get out of them by driving the level of private debt down. That was both first of all, the Great Depression, but also the Second World War drove the debt level down. This has been our progress from the post-war period forward. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's where we are right now. Now, there's no way that we're out of that yet. And one of the scariest things is, I have a copy of Chrome running here. I just want to bring up a data series, which the debt levels, I just want to look for weekly data, if I can actually do this. Pardon me being a bit sloppy here. I'm not going to find it in a hurry, but what I've seen is about the level of short-term corporate debt has risen from about $2 trillion to $3 trillion over the last 4 weeks to 6 weeks. I'll just go back to not sharing my screen anymore, so...
In the past, obviously, companies have been able to refinance their debt at a lower rate, right? But with the rate sitting at zero, how will this be refinanced? I mean, does that mean a lot of the companies are actually going to go bust this time?
We face a massive level of bankruptcies. And it's because we haven't, it's just not realized by most economists that this actually matters. They ignore the level of private debt. I found the data share as I'm looking for, so I'll share this now if I can.
Sure.
Let's see if I can come back. And am I sharing and not sharing screen? Let's see.
I can't see it just yet. I can see.
Okay, let's.
But is there a particular reason that this private debt is being ignored?
The economic theory doesn't think it has any role. That's why economists just don't believe that level of private debt matters. So therefore, they don't consider it. It's insane, but that's the nature of mainstream economic theory. So you read Ben Bernanke. He argues that the level of private debt doesn't matter, and changes in private debt don't matter. But he says pure redistributions should have no substantial macroeconomic effect. Oh, I can see. Okay. This is the level of commercial industry loans in the States. And you can see, this is the weekly series, you can see a bit of a gradual increase since the financial crisis. And look at here. It goes from $2.35 trillion in February 5 to $3.8 trillion in May 13. So over 3 months, we've had about a $700 billion increase in the level of commercial loans. Now, that's short-term stuff mainly. That is corporations that are finding they're going bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And they're running out their lines of credit. They're running out their overdrafts effectively. And that's because they've got no cash flow coming in, but they've still got their financial commitments going out. So they're likely to fold. And there's going to be, I think Hertz is just the very first of a large wave of bankruptcies we're going to have to cope with.
What is your understanding of swap lines, Steve?
I'm not really into the technical. That's an area which is rather more technical, and I don't follow that. I follow the macroeconomic data rather than the fine data. You're better off talking to people like Perry Merling on that sort of stuff than me.
Sure. No, that's cool. Are we going into the deflation, hyperinflation, or it's deflation then hyperinflation, or is it stagflation? Where are we headed towards?
Deflation, again, because the level of private debt being so massive, corporate, particularly with the collapse in cash flow and the massive levels of private debt, corporations are going to be cutting their prices to try to drag customers in through their doors rather than their competitive rivals' doors. And that process went a general fall on the price level, which is exactly what happened back in 1930, 32, 33. And what you had then was actually falling private debt and a rising private debt ratio because GDP was falling faster and people were cutting their debt. Irving Fisher put it in terms of saying, the more debtors pay, the more they owe. And I call that Fisher's paradox. And we're going to see that happen again.
Is it a short-term deflation before we go into the hyperinflation? Because at some stage, the asset prices have to shoot up once again, or is it going to be permanent deflation in deflationary environment?
The central bank can pump up asset prices quite easily. That's what QE itself has been doing. Okay, so you could potentially see asset price inflation, and perhaps we're seeing that right now. A large amount of the money the Fed's creating is going straight to the financial sector, and what do? They buy shares with it. But in terms of getting into the real economy, bugger all is getting in there compared to what's been taken out. So you have the money coming out in two ways. First of all, workers aren't able to earn salaries, so they've got financial commitments they're required to meet, their rents and their mortgages, and no cash flow to pay it. So therefore, their debts are racking up. Their cash is going from them to the financial sector, or them to the landlords and so on, and they can't afford to continue operating. So their spending power has been destroyed, and we're talking about 70% of the population in that sense. Certainly in America's case, we'd be talking about at least 20% being unemployed. Okay, so their spending power is completely obliterated. So that's deflationary on a grand scale. They're going to be out there, you know, lining up at food banks and things like that to stay alive. They're not going to be demanding wage rises. Then you have corporations which are running up debt as well because they're not getting the cash flow from the workers and so on, they're going to be deflationary, and they've got an increasing level of debt at the same time because their lines of credit are being tapped into, or their overdrafts and so on. So we have a huge level of overhang of private debt, a collapse in cash flows. So I can't see inflation at all. I think people are expecting an inflationary surge out of this aren't seeing how much money is being destroyed by the increase in debt and people trying to repay their debt, and therefore by doing that, destroying money in the process, more than counteracting what's being injected in by the Fed.
With all the debt, deflation plus debt, that's a ticking time bomb. Or are we saying that Fed will keep pumping the asset prices however they do it through different mechanics?
Read Irving Fisher's debt deflation theory of Great Depression. That's on the web. It's a PDF, easily locatable. And he talks about the combination of debt deflation causing the Great Depression, and he's quite right. The people who, like Bernanke, reject Fisher on the basis of neoclassical thought. So they haven't got a clue what they're talking about. Fisher was right, they're wrong. Now what they're doing is pumping up asset markets and hoping that will cause a real economy to get stimulated, when we've seen how QE does work to some degree, but you get, you know, each $10 in, you might get $1 of bang out of it for the real economy. And if they continue doing it, we're going to get inflating asset prices, but a collapsing real economy. And they will not do it on a scale that's necessary to revive the private sector. This is a totally unexpected experience, both by mainstream people and also by people like myself, in terms of, you know, I'm expecting global warming to start smashing us up, but I wasn't expecting it to start with a pandemic. But the impact of that is mainly on people who are just working to stay alive. They're the ones who can't earn wages anymore. And it's on and it's destroyed the cash flows of corporations as well at the same time. Now, if the financial sector's commitments are maintained, both the workers and the real corporations go under. And in that situation, you can't restart the economy because there is no cash in the economy. It's all claims. It's basically been replaced by claims by the financial sector. If we let that happen, we're going to be in the greatest of depressions. We're in deflation now. Again, if you take a look at the Federal Reserve, the Fed database on the CPI, you can see that already prices, it's even turning up in the most recent data, there's a downturn in the price level right now. So we're in deflation, and it's going to get more extreme. Have a look. Okay, this is the change in the index, okay? Mm-hmm. The American CPI, okay, for all consumers. So over the month, it's fallen 2%. This is from March to April. That's the impact of the coronavirus, right down here. Yep. Now, the only comparative deflationary surges are back in 2015, which is just a blip for a month. And that, of course, during the financial crisis itself, that was a huge downturn, but they spent their way out of that very radically. This is going to go far deeper than where it is right now. Okay, we're going to be in serious deflation. That's looking at the change in the monthly index, the percent change in the monthly index. It doesn't turn up as much when you look at the annual as yet, but it will.
So you're saying it's more going to be like 1930s, essentially?
Yeah, unless we massively increase government spending, definitely.
Which they have been talking about through infrastructure spending and all that stuff, whether that happens or not.
Yeah, but it's not. Again, infrastructure spending takes too long a time to do. That's the sort of thing you do when you've got planning time ahead of you. Okay, it takes a long time to get an infrastructure project going, particularly if you hadn't even thought of it before you came up with the idea in the first place. It's one where you think it is a straight government money creation going directly to people is what we need, which is why I'm talking in favour of my modern debt jubilee idea.
Right. Okay. Talk a little bit about the modern debt jubilee.
It's something I thought would never happen. Okay. So I put it forward. People said, what would you do to get out of this? And I proposed it, but thought there's no point wasting any time working on it because it'll never happen. Okay. Now it may be the only way out. And to some extent, this is being, I've seen some public officials talking about it. A debt jubilee, obviously, the abolition is saying people don't have to pay their debt back. And there's been a history of debt jubilees going right back to the Sumerian time, but Michael Hudson is the expert on that. My idea of a modern debt jubilee is to use the government's money creation capability to inject an equivalent amount per person into the economy through people's bank accounts, or preferably to set up central bank digital currencies so we can everybody can have an account at the central bank and the money can be put directly into that account. So it goes to everybody on a per capita basis. Rupert Murdoch could get as much as you and me. The people who receive it, if they have debt, they must use it to pay their debt down. Okay? People who don't have debt who get it, can have several potential outcomes there, but the one which I predominantly argue for is that they should be required to use that money to buy newly issued corporate shares, which are used to reduce corporate debt. And that would mean you'd reduce both household debt directly through people paying off their debt and corporate debt indirectly by requiring those households without debt to buy shares with that money. And then the corporation being required to use that money to cancel their corporate debt. So that could, we did it, say, like an injection equivalent to 100% of GDP, we could reduce the debt load from 150% in America to up to 50%. And then we're back in the range that applied back in the golden age of capitalism, where the debt burden on the economy is much, much lower. What you've done, you haven't actually created money in circulation. Okay? You've used the government's money creation capability to convert the money that exists from being credit-based money to fiat-based money. And then you've reduced the level of credit debt on the other side of the ledger. So that's the basic proposal, to use that the accounting potential of the government to eliminate at least something at the order of 100% of GDP of private debt while we're keeping the money supply constant. So it's not an inflationary thing. But then what you would have is people being far less financially burdened, far more likely to spend out of the money they do have. You'd have a high rate of circulation coming out of it. You get a stimulus that way. And you'd also have to stop the banks lending, creating another financial bubble. So I'd have controls on how much banks can lend for asset purchases. I'd abolish margin debt. I wouldn't allow people to buy shares on margin anymore. That's been an incredibly deadly part of stock market behavior for the last couple of centuries. But I'd also say that, for example, in buying a house, there should be the limit on the debt that anyone, you or me or Rupert Murdoch, can take on to buy a property should be 10 times the notional income, rental income of that property. And that would mean that, like, if you saw a house being advertised for sale, you'd see a sign saying the maximum amount that can be borrowed against it, period. So the only way that you and I, if we were competing over the same house, one of us could beat the others by saving more money to buy it. And you'd break the positive feedback between house prices and mortgage debt, which currently exists. So a range of proposals like that to basically stop the financial sector funding asset bubbles.
Right. Okay. The bond yields, do you think they are going to negative?
Because government bonds might well, because people want to have a safe haven for their money, given how volatile risky assets are, that that's quite possible. It's a crazy element of just how, the fact that we've got to this point shows how little the people in charge understand the system.
And if they do go, what does that mean for the asset prices?
Well, that can actually push up the share prices. I think we've let share prices get far too high. Again, public data gives you an idea of just how ridiculous share prices are. If you've seen the Shiller-Cape Index, which is the index developed by Robert Shiller to show the ratio of share prices to earnings over the last 10 years, and that's an extremely good guide to show just whether the share markets are sensibly valued or not. And this is, that's the Case-Shiller Index. That was the 1929 bubble, peak of 1929. That was the 2000 bubble, which is the biggest bubble in history. And this is where we got to with QE, before QE started. That's where QE drove us to. This is where we are right now. We are still in a massively overvalued territory for share markets. When the share market plunged back to 666 about here, it was only slightly below its long-term average, which is about this level. So what central banks have done by maintaining QE is continue pushing up share prices as if that's what's always happened. No, it isn't. Okay, we're basically, if you look here, that's Black Tuesday, the stock market crash in 1929. QE drove prices above that level, so it was never a sensible policy.
Right, that's good. According to you, that means there's a possibility that this rebound in the stock market that we saw after the March crash is going to go back and test the lows again.
It could, but central banks have got an infinite capacity to inflate those markets. That's what worries me. They'll go back and do that. This is a dramatic shock to the real economy, and there's no way the valuations make any sense in terms of price to earnings ratios. Yeah. So if we continue having the central banks pushing it up despite those price-to-earnings ratio, then we're going to get an artificial bubble, which they can sustain indefinitely. There's no limit on their capacity to do that. But it completely disconnects the financial markets from the real world, And it's putting the rescuing the financial markets ahead of rescuing the real economy. And that has been an insanely bad policy, which I just want to see ended.
I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this. If they don't do that, then all the pension liabilities that they have got, what's going to happen to that?
Well, that was another mistake. I mean, we pushed people off pensions, which were provided by the state, and told them you've got to go and gamble on the stock market yourselves and pay superannuation schemes and stuff like that, which is just you generate another form of financial parasite in the private pension system. We should always have had government pension providing that money. It was a mistake to take it off the government books. And now, of course, people's livelihoods are tied up with an inflating asset market. Which, of course, means that you have this political interest group trying to push share prices higher, which, as I said, we've already pushed them beyond the level they were back in the 1920 Mark IX stock market crash. So it's been, it's distorted. I'm not a great fan of the argument that governments always distort the private sector. But by trying to support the financial markets, that's what the central banks have done. Yeah, sorry. I'm actually going to have to go, Jazz. I've got a couple of major work commitments that just come in as emails for me, I'm afraid. I'm sorry, but I just have a really, really busy week this week, and that's got on top of me.
Do you want to summarize this, what this actually all means before you leave?
Well, I think probably the best thing I can do is tell people to go to my Patreon page. I think, as you know, the Patreon page is most of the posts there are publicly available. There's not a cost to for people to go and read them. And I put a blog post there on some of the issues we've been speaking about today, which I'm just going to go and find the link for it now, and I'll share that with you. Mm-hmm. So I recommend people want to follow up, then go and check out that that blog post and plenty of others on Patreon. As I said, they're almost all free access. I'm just scrolling through, pardon me, right now, trying to find the one that I want to refer people to read about, because it is the issue you've been raising about whether we face inflation or deflation. So I went through some of the technical elements of that argument there. I'm spinning out here because I'm waiting for my website to wake up. Very frustrating. It's just I'm spinning a spinning wheel in front of me. I was going to see if I can. Oh, here we go. Finally, okay. So I'll just actually take a copy of that and just. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll have a read of it. Yeah.
Okay. So that covers the most of the deals we were trying to have a discussion about today.
Appreciate your time, Steve. We'll probably talk about Australian property market at some point in the future, but this one was more about the macro stuff. So appreciate your time. Thanks for that.
Okay. Bye.
Take care, buddy.
Bye. You too.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.